Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
This is a fraud on the American public. This is an embarrassment to our country. We were getting ready to win this election. Frankly, we did win this election.
Well, hello, everybody. This is Paul Listick. Welcome to Behind the Curtain. You remember that famous speech, that famous phrase on election night, which kind of triggered all sorts of questions about the 2020 election after that. But that line, frankly, we did win this election, that's what set it off. And my guest for this show is the author of a new book called Frankly, We Did Win This Election. But the title goes on to say, the inside story of how Trump lost. My guest is Michael C. Bender. He's the White House senior reporter for the Wall Street Journal, author of the book. Perhaps you saw him on my WGN-TV political report show Sunday morning a few weeks back, but now we get to talk more in depth. Michael, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
So, well, it's fair to say your book clearly immerses the reader into that final year of the Trump presidency. I mean, it's clearly chaotic. People surrounding him feared what could happen, things that he could do. But here's the thing. For my listeners who are supporters of President Trump, before we even start, they're probably saying to themselves, well, you're just a never Trumper. You set out to write a hatchet job about their former president and their hero. What do you say to them?
I guess I would say that they're not familiar with the book or the work that I've been doing for the Wall Street Journal for covering Trump for the past, is going on 6 years now. I would take issue with anyone that calls it a hatchet job, certainly, or a book about, for never Trumpers. I reported what I saw and what I was told, and yes, Trump did attack me and attack this book for different parts of it, but that was because he knew who I was talking to for this book. He knew that people were talking to me around him who don't normally talk to reporters, and they were speaking with me because of the way I've covered Trump for the last 5 years, which is with as straight of a bat as anyone in the mainstream media. And I think what ends up here is that the product is unlike any other Trump book, I believe, available. There are behind the scenes anecdotes and stories in the West Wing that have gotten a lot of attention on CNN and MSNBC and Fox News. A lot of the stories we're hearing now about Mark Milley, those were first reported in my book that came out in July. The first time that Mark Milley as a character in the Trump administration really started to take shape. And this book also does two other things. It goes underneath the hood of a $2 billion presidential campaign to explain in new ways why Trump spent twice as much as he did in 2016 and lost. The last thing I'll say is what this book does, and what certainly nothing has done to date, is I effectively embedded for 2 years with a group of Trump supporters, the folks who go to 30 and 40 and 50 Trump rallies to understand them and their lives and what about them as humans and Americans and Republicans made them want to see the Trump show, the Trump rally, time and time again. I would put that up against anything, available in what is, I will acknowledge, a veritable library worth of Trump books available over the last 30 years and this year and more to come this year.
And as you say, you talked to over 150 advisors and personnel about the president. You did talk to the president twice, you say, at Mar-a-Lago. And as much as he ends up calling you a third-rate journalist who wrote a book filled with falseheads, mm-hmm. no surprise, mm-hmm. I have to give you credit. He loves your hair. You do have very Trumpian hair.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was Trump has never missed an opportunity to compliment my hair, which I take as a huge compliment coming from coming from someone like Donald Trump, who spent so much time, thinking about his own hair. And I'm glad he never, when he did attack me over some of the reporting in my book, I'm glad he never criticized my hair, or else I would have known something was really wrong. I went down to Mar-a-Lago twice to interview him for this book. I've interviewed him a dozen times in the Oval Office, Air Force One, to Trump Tower. And, I'll tell your listeners, he called me a week and a half ago and I interviewed him again for some stories I'm working on for the Wall Street Journal. So, we can argue over specific points in the book, and that's fine. But at the end of the day, I think Trump sees me as and views me as fair of a reporter working in the mainstream press that's covering him now.
You know, you tell a little story even before the prologue in the book, which I have read cover to cover, and I know a lot of my listeners will, because it's a fantastic mm-hmm. book, so well documented. But you have this little conversation between Mike Biondo, a New Hampshire-based Republican strategist for Trump, and a guy named Tony Fabrizio, who's a Trump pollster. I got to modify the language a little bit because there's some bad words in here, which I know I can use on a podcast, mm-hmm. but I won't. But basically, Mike says, so there's good news and bad news, and Tony says, yeah, what's that? And Mike says, the good news is I'm sorry, this is 2016. I'm taking you to 2016. The good news is we won. The bad news is these stupid people are going to think this is the way you win a presidential election. That's November 9th, 2016. Yeah. So why did you open the book with that? Yeah, we won. People are going to think this is how you win.
Well, I think it's a really illustrative quote in the sense that the dynamics we see that start in right after 2016, that right into the White House, and that are through lines through the administration and into the final campaign, is that the people around Trump were always arguing over who deserved credit for that 2016 win. Brad Parscale kind of came out of nowhere a few months after, within a couple of months after the election for this Facebook strategy. Jared Kushner was telling people in Washington that the digital strategy was his the whole time. Steve Bannon was on the cover of a couple books before the administration was 6 months old, and he got booted out in no small part because of the attention he was getting. You had Reince Priebus in the Oval Office there for a few months. Kellyanne Conway, the first female campaign manager to win a presidential campaign, and certainly on the Republican side, Biden's campaign manager this year was the first female on the Democratic side, but. Is the first woman to lead a campaign as the campaign manager to win a presidential election. And, I think that fact might surprise some of your listeners, right? She never really got that attention. And part of the reason she kind of hung around for so long, I believe, was a bid to, prove the need to feel that she felt she had to prove herself again in that world. When the truth was, there was no playbook. No one had the playbook for what happened in 2016. So, amid all of this arguing over who did what or who is the real mastermind behind all of this, the truth was it was Trump and his phone and calling into media shows and driving that narrative, and a historically unpopular candidate on the side of in the form of Hillary Clinton. But this sort of infighting just is what. Trips up so much of Trump's administration and plays a large role in his undoing in 2020.
One of the just powerful elements of the book are these stories you have of people who are, become so enraptured by him. The early part of the book, you write about this woman named Sandra who just got sucked in. I think you said she was, well, I read this a while ago, but she was watching TV. She wasn't a Trump supporter. She just sees him as one of his rallies and becomes devoted. And at one point, I write, you travel, she asked you to share a room. And you're like, I don't think we should do that.
Yeah, I mean, they form this kind of community, their own little community around Trump, right? I mean, the people who end up going to all these shows, all these rallies are, you know, I say shows, it's not unlike like a Grateful Dead kind of crowd or, you know, Bruce Springsteen kind of crowd, you know, the people who show up to those kind of concerts over and over again. And what happens there as well as here is a kind of little community formed. And when it came to the Trump rally goers, you know, they were, Trump had kind of made their lives bigger and richer. They had, you know, had recently retired with time on their hands, maybe never had kids or were estranged from their families. And this gave them people to, you know, to meet on the road, meet up with them on the road or share hotel rooms with or stay at each other's house. A couple of them had met and married, you know, also divorced by the time before the administration was over. But still, you know, those are major life experiences. And I think what the story that that I tell their story that I tell is that how they're kind of misled over the course of 2020, whether it be COVID, you know, Rand, I talked to Randall who won't go to the hospital, even though he's, you know, horribly sick because he's afraid of not of testing positive, but just of taking any kind of test and showing up as a adding to the numbers under Trump, number of Americans tested, number of Americans who tested positive under Trump. You know, that kind of political loyalty, the loyalty to Trump supersedes his own health, you know. And you know, Sandra ends up at the Capitol. She doesn't go into the Capitol on January 6th, but she's outside the Capitol, you know, talking about what a wonderful thing it is to see, you know, the riot unfolding in the name of a fight she believes is to install the rightful winner of the election, Donald J. Trump.
And while I could talk for an hour for you just about this sort of 2020 and what led him to win, just a quick question on that, because I want to get to some of the specifics. But is it fair to say that while he never expected to win in 2016 and thought he would lose thought he couldn't lose in 2020, would you agree? Mm-hmm. He thought it was all about, I think actually you write this, he thought it was all about a strong economy. And the truth is, had he handled COVID differently, more with more compassion, with more focus, he probably would have won 2020.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can really make that argument. You know, obviously, I don't know the answer to that. Let me answer it a couple of different ways here. One is, I put that question to several people closest to Trump, the people who were, you know, making the decisions, whether it be on the campaign or in the White House, and sometimes both. And no one really had a good answer for that. One of the most striking answers was a very senior member of the administration who said, well, if it wasn't COVID, Trump would have found something else to screw up. I mean, it effectively was the quote. Yeah, I mean, I worked in Florida for a long time as a journalist and saw the hurricanes come through there and saw how someone like Jeb Bush responded. And I saw a lot of parallels when it came to COVID. No one ever blamed Jeb Bush for the hurricanes, right? They blamed him or rewarded him for his response to the hurricanes. And that's the same thing we saw with COVID. No one ever, even at the beginning, no one was blaming Trump for the outbreak of a pandemic, of a global pandemic, right? It was when people were frustrated over and questioned the seriousness of his response that he started to take on water. And the kind of final point I make on this is that I actually think the biggest single moment for Trump politically in 2020 was the first debate in Cleveland with Joe Biden, where he came out with just full of anger and repeatedly interrupted Biden over and over and over again. Without any of the, I'm going to call it humor, right? That he was known for in 2016. He's always been abrasive, and he's always had an abrasive style of politics. But it's always been done with a sort of in a kind of joking manner, and not trying to suggest that this is, to normalize it or cast judgment on one way or another. But it was always mocking, though, and that kind of humor aspect of it took some of the edge off, and kind of added. It was part of the reason people liked Trump. But what he did in that debate in Cleveland was none of the mocking. It was all of the anger. It was all of the aggression. And the numbers just dropped off the cliff immediately after that, even before he tested positive for COVID a couple of days later. And which brings it back to kind of part of your question is, that I think that was the big difference between his debates in 2020 and 2016. In 2020, he had something to lose. In 2016, no one thought he was going to win the primary, let alone the general. And now suddenly he was, everything was wrapped up in this, in the second election. He was, he spent most of that first term feeling like he had to validate the results of his first election. And this was an opportunity to do that. And certainly, didn't want to be lumped in with the group of presidents who had not won a second term. So all of that was wrapped up in, a COVID, spreading, the economy has fallen through the floor. There's the civil justice protests are still in full force throughout the country. All these things have kind of like ripped the rug underneath Trump, and he was desperate to grab onto something to moor himself, and the result was what we saw in Cleveland.
And with regard to COVID, I mean, you have new reporting in the book that there were actually more positive tests of him having COVID, showing positive. They may have been false positives, but he had positive tests. Mm-hmm. And in fact, he was much closer to death than we were ever told.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there was there's a lot more to know about what actually happened those few days when Trump tested positive. I think this book gives as fulsome of a picture as that we know to this point. And part of that is there's one of the striking things to me in re-reporting some of this was no one knew. No one seems to know really what happened with his test that day. I mean, the morning he tests positive on very late at night, or almost 24 hours earlier, one of his closest aides had tested positive. And the White House never had an explanation for why Trump hadn't tested earlier, right? I mean, if one of his closest personal aides had tested positive, it's strange credulity to think that Trump wouldn't be tested or test himself until almost 24 hours later, right? I mean, and one of the explanations that among senior officials in the White House was that he had tested positive that morning. But he believed it was a false positive, which, again, if true, and part of the reason why was because he had had false positive tests previously in the year that we had not known about. And if that's true, I mean, it's a stunning lack of regard for the people around him and his own health. I mean, if you remember, in between that morning and that night, he left for a fundraiser. He went to a fundraiser at Bedminster. And he's on Marine One. He was on the Marine One helicopter and the Air Force One airplane with staff, with Secret Service, with reporters. Again, I mean, I think there's a lot more to know, and the things we learned for the first time in this book really only raise more questions.
And so much to talk to you about. We have about 8 minutes left, but I want to try and get so much in. Mm-hmm. With regard to George Floyd, we talked about that on the TV show. People can watch the clips of that. And you talked about the fact that Trump was actually very moved by the videos of George Floyd. But ultimately, mm-hmm. as the protests start, one of the lessons of your book is that Trump takes everything personally. It leads to one of the great stories. I know one that really mattered to you as well, which is, Trump, Trump went from, I don't know what he went from, but all of a sudden it's break the skulls of the protesters and shoot him in the leg and all this kind of stuff. You have a great story about General Milley, who, of course, is back in the news lately, and something he says to Trump, so powerful.
Yeah, Trump is desperate to kind of reassert himself in this moment, and feels like the Floyd protests are a reflection on him, right? And that he had been pushed for years to do some repair work, really, his relationship with the black community, and he ended up signing legislation to reform some criminal justice laws and to secure some money for historically black colleges and universities in perpetuity moving forward. And when he sees these protests, he feels like those bits of legislation should have inoculated the country from these kind of protests, when the reality is they had nothing to do with Trump. They had nothing to do with his agenda. This was years of racial indignities, large and small, suffered by black Americans, and an outpouring of that emotion. But what happens here is Trump tries to respond to those protests with force, and what he wants to do is, as you were saying, he wants to bring uniformed military soldiers into major American cities, into the U.S. Capitol, to put down largely peaceful protesters. And the debate is raging through the Oval Office. There's a couple of dozen aides, West Wing aides, national security aides, military aides in there, back and forth, going back and forth on the risks of this. Someone like General Milley, who's commanded troops in the Middle East, understands the difference between bringing in the National Guard, which is a quasi police, trained in law enforcement, versus bringing in 20 to 25 year old active duty troops who have been trained to kill and take land. Right. And it is a very big difference between those two groups of people. And Milley understands that. And finally, in the middle of all this, points to a portrait of Abraham Lincoln over Trump's shoulder inside the Oval Office and says, "That man, Mr. President, that man had an insurrection. What we have is a protest."
And it's fascinating, Mike, too, when we look at, of course, this new book now by Bob Woodward, Bob Costa, that's out, called Peril, and it picks up on so much of what you're talking about. Just out of curiosity, is there anything from your familiarity of that book? And as we speak, it's not released yet. We're just hearing what we see in the media and the press, but you have connections. It seems to me that a lot of what's in that book probably verifies your research. Some of it starts in your research and work, and and now, of course, Republicans want General Milley to pay hell for what he did.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, what my book does is, for the first time, gives a sort of a complete picture of the role Milley played behind the scenes during 2020. And and Milley hasn't really spoken about any of this publicly, and maybe he won't. But there's some of the accusations that are now coming out, that we've seen in the Woodward book, it's going to put some pressure on Milley to give his version of this, of some of these moments on the record. And, there are some differences in some of the reporting, and there's been some differing accounts, on exactly what Milley did, with regards to China and the kind of conversations he was having with the Chinese that are a little that came out this week, actually, with from John Swan at Axios, that differ a little bit in small but significant ways from what we've seen in the Woodward book. So it will be interesting to see what if Milley tries to set the record straight and how he does it.
And finally, before out of time, you also write in the book, after the election, Trump felt completely lost, basically at one point asking, "What do I do now?" And you said the answer seems to be 36 holes of golf a day. But the question is this: I know everybody asks you, do you think he's going to run in 2024? And in some of the interviews I've seen you do, you kind of step away from that question because it's too early. I get that. But, at this point, he seems to be a man who's pretty committed to running in 2024. He's got nothing else to do.
Well, it's a good point, and I think that's the right point. Is what we're seeing from Trump now in the last it's been 10 months since the 2020 election's been called. So not that long, and yet we've seen a lot of political activity from Trump at Mar-a-Lago and from Bedminster. And to me, what that says is it's not telling to me yet that Trump is going to run. What it is very telling to me, I think what these moves do show is that Trump is preserving his ability to make that decision. He is someone who does not want to give any quarter to any other potential opponents. You know, we were talking a little bit about his law and order image. I mean, part of the reason, in my reporting for this book is that he was so aggressive in his law and order politics is that he doesn't want anyone to get to the right of him, right? And he doesn't want anyone. He doesn't give anyone the chance to encroach on his base of support. And that's what we're seeing now is Trump tending to that base and telling them that he's still here, he's still involved, he still matters, he's still relevant. He's maintaining his relevancy so that when after the 2022 elections and when it comes time to make a decision, he's in a position to do that. And he's made, close to 40, I think it's over 40 endorsements now since he's left office. Most of those are in the Senate, almost as many in the House so far, and in some tough races. I mean, in Republican primaries, he's backing challengers. That's not an easy thing to pull off, even for a popular former president. So, how some of those tougher races pan out, the primary challengers pan out, those will all be data points for him when it comes to making a decision about not just whether to run, but whether he can win.
You make a great point. I mean, going after for example, he's endorsing the challenger to Liz Cheney. Oh, there's going to be fascinating things to watch in 2022 right. And sees what happened. 30 minutes, Michael, and we've hardly scratched the surface of all the new reporting of this book. But it's called Frankly, We Did Win This Election, The Inside Story of How Trump Lost, a great book by Michael C. Bender. I hope everybody picks it up and reads it. It just, you think you know the story, you don't know the story until you read this book. Michael, would love to stay in touch with you because I'm sure your reporting and insight will continue. And I thank you for your time today. Appreciate you.
Hey, thank you so much. I just really appreciate it. I'm so excited. We made the New York Times bestseller list. We're in our third printing right now. We just made a list today of best political books of 2021. So I really appreciate the time you take to talk about this with your listeners and that you took to read it. And I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
My pleasure. It's a great book. So well told. It's like just reading I wouldn't call it a bedtime story, but it's like reading a well told story. And I look forward to your next work. Michael Bender, thank you so much. Just great work. Senior White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal. You do great stuff and we'll stay in touch. Thank you.
Bye.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes and tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.